cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, we're continuing our coverage of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, wiping out the constitutional right to abortion. Earlier in the afternoon, President Joe Biden weighed in. Check out what he had to say.
It's a realization of an extreme ideology and a tragic error by the Supreme Court, in my view. The court has done what it has never done before, expressly take away a constitutional right that is so fundamental to so many Americans that it had already been recognized.
That was President Joe Biden with his initial response, at least, to the Roe v. Wade ruling today, or the ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. Joining us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studios, June Grasso, Bloomberg News legal analyst. She and I spent most of the morning together today talking about this story. And I know since that time, she has literally been pouring over this statement and the case. What's new?
Well, this morning we were talking about, you know, the repercussions of this decision and what it might mean for contraception and gay marriage and all these decisions based on privacy. And the dissent predicted that, quote, no one should be confident that this majority is done with its work. And Justice Thomas, in his concurrence, he actually said we should reconsider all of the court's substantive due process precedents, including Griswold, that's privacy, Lawrence, that's marriage, and Obergefell, which is same-sex marriage. So he's inviting people to challenge that. So people who say, let's not panic, read that opinion. It's
so you're saying, June, you are saying that Justice Clarence Thomas, in the text today, is essentially inviting cases to overturn gay marriage, to overturn the right to be in a same-sex relationship?
Yes, and he has succeeded. He has been saying that people should challenge the Second Amendment, and that the Second Amendment was not, you know, was a secondary, people considered it a secondary constitutional right. It wasn't like on the same level as the First Amendment, et cetera. And he won with that one yesterday. So, you know.
I mean, so anything in the – there's really nothing surprising in how the vote went down. Is that right? I mean –
There's nothing surprising because we got that draft.
Okay. And do we know anything more about that, where that may have come
from? No, we don't know anything about that. And that's sort of what's puzzling to me is that – now, my opinion – this is just my opinion.
Okay.
No basis in fact for this. But we know it is true that the justice – Chief Justice decided that the marshal, the Supreme Court marshal, would do the investigation instead of – for example, the FBI.
Okay.
That lets them have control over what the marshal finds. They may know at this point who leaked that. They may not tell us.
Why does that matter so much?
Well, it matters to the court because after that leak, Justice Clarence Thomas said something to the effect of, I'm looking over my shoulder now. It has destroyed the confidence and trust on the court. And it's something that they want to find out so that it doesn't happen again.
It's interesting that you mentioned the confidence and trust of the court because Susan Collins, Senator Susan Collins, voted to confirm Kavanaugh and Gorsuch. And earlier today, she put out a statement that said this decision is inconsistent with what Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh said in their testimony and their meetings with me, where they both were insistent on the importance of supporting longstanding precedents that the country has relied upon.
Well, it's not only inconsistent with what they told her. Also, Joe Manchin said something similar, Senator Joe Manchin. But all the Supreme Court, conservative Supreme Court justices in their testimony, because I've gone back, said that Roe is an established right, even Justice Alito. So he said that then. And Kavanaugh was really emphatic about it. It's an established right. It's been established.
Did their minds change when they were the oral arguments, or would it be fair to say that they perhaps weren't necessarily being truthful in their testimony?
I don't want to say they weren't being truthful in their testimony. Perhaps the way they felt the way they worded it. I mean, I have to say that Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, was more forthcoming in her testimony.
Right.
She said it's not a super right, whatever she called it, a super precedent. So she said it's a precedent, but not a super precedent. She said that only super precedents can be overturned.
Is that a thing?
It's not a thing.
You went to law school.
Is
that a chapter I missed?
It wasn't a thing at Harvard. Okay. I don't know. Where'd she go? She went to Notre Dame.
All right. Noah Feldman, Bloomberg Opinion columnist. I'm going to call out and refer to this note probably a couple times today, out with a column today. And the title just grabbed me, the headline, Abortion Ruling is Suicidal for the Supreme Court. Boy, that's strong language there.
It's strong language, but we have a Supreme Court that the supermajority on the court now is out of step with the majority of Americans because in every single poll—
And that kind of goes to how you interpret the Constitution. Is it just a concrete thing that doesn't change?
Yes.
Or does it expand and contract with society and evolve and things like that?
When Justice Scalia was alive, he and Justice Breyer would do these sort of dueling Constitution lectures, and Justice Scalia would talk about originalism and textualism, and Justice Breyer would talk about the living Constitution.
Yes.
The problem now is you have six people who believe in textualism and some who are real adherents to textualism. So that's how we got, I believe, to these two decisions, which yesterday they went back to the 1700s and 1800s. Today's decision, they went back to the 1500s, 1600s. I mean, it's jarring for someone to think that, I think the founders were very wise, but how could the founders anticipate the kind of world we have today?
I mean, look what the founders included in the Constitution about slavery.
Exactly.
And then
you
have to look no further than the 14th Amendment to understand that document was something that has been living and changing.
That's why this decision today is so shaking.
Right.
It's sort of put you off balance because, what about precedent now? Does that mean that they're not going to rely on precedent anymore? It's very scary in a way.
Well, we'll certainly keep turning to you. That's June Grasso. She's Bloomberg News legal analyst, also the host of Bloomberg Law, weeknights at 10 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio, with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, he's a Nobel laureate, a columnist for the New York Times, and the distinguished professor of economics at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Also the author or editor of more than two dozen books, including The Return of Depression Economics and Arguing with Zombies, among others. Paul Krugman, welcome back to Bloomberg Businessweek Radio. It's great to have you with us. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
We're doing okay. I want to start with the Supreme Court decision. I saw you were tweeting about it. We learned today, of course, that the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, wiping out the constitutional right to an abortion. Now, we've already seen companies like J.P. Morgan and others come out today and say that they're going to pay for employees to travel to other states if needed to obtain a legal abortion. I'm wondering about the economic effects of this. Do you see any ripple effect in the U.S. economy as a result of this decision?
Well, probably not in terms of the macro numbers. I think there may be some regional aspects. I mean, one of the big driving forces of change in the U.S. economy over the past couple of decades has been this kind of unequalizing as the knowledge economy has wanted to gravitate towards, you know, big cities with highly educated populations. And now there's going to be an additional factor, which is if companies want the kind of workers that they can get in those locations, are they going to want to locate in the states that are going to be have really, you know, regressive social policies, the kinds of social policies that the workers they want really don't like? So you really have to think, you know, how does Texas or Florida fare in this kind of competition for business in this new legal environment?
Florida seems to be doing pretty well. We saw Citadel move down there, and lots of other companies. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out over time. So, Paul, just wondering here, I think, you know, as Tim and I speak to various fund managers and C-suite folks, one of the questions, obviously, today is this Federal Reserve. They have a balancing act, a very tough balancing act, to rein in inflation while not going too far and pushing this economy into a recession. How do you think that plays out?
Well, I mean, the fundamental problem does not actually look to me to be all that hard. It's a weird thing to say, but it's pretty clear that the U.S. economy got overheated. Fiscal and monetary policy, it was misjudged. I was among the people who misjudged it, and the U.S. economy got overheated. And so we have, you know, most of the inflation we're seeing is special factors that will go away. Russia won't invade Ukraine every month. But there's a good solid extra, maybe 2 points of inflation, excess inflation that result from an overheated economy. Cooling off that overheating is not fundamentally a hard thing to do, and needn't be all that hard, needn't even involve a recession, just a little bit of an uptick in the unemployment rate. The problem is precision. I mean, the Fed is not sure how overheated the economy is. It doesn't know exactly how much of a rate rise is needed to do this. So the chance of you know, overdoing it, of slamming the brakes a little too hard and causing a bit of a skid is definitely there. So it's a reasonable chance that we'll have something that will be formally a recession, but the chance of a really, you know, sort of early 80s type grueling and anti-inflation flight, that doesn't look serious.
How deep of a recession could we have? How long of a recession? How high could unemployment go?
How high it could go could be over, I mean, it probably has to rise over 4. And it's not hard to come up with a story in which the Fed bobbles the thing badly enough that it briefly goes above 5. But briefly, there's nothing at all in there to suggest that we need an unemployment rate that's over 5 for any extended period of time. And the Fed will course correct if it does look like we're heading in that direction.
So just to that point, Paul, Larry Sumner's is out with an idea of 5 years of 5% unemployment needed to bring down CPI. That doesn't necessarily seem to hold water to you?
That looks to me like Larry is, for reasons I do not understand, thinking that we need something that's like a sort of a half Volcker, that we need a massive period of excess unemployment for an extended period of time to crush inflationary expectations. So, which is what we had in the early 80s, except every indicator I look at says that inflationary expectations are actually pretty muted. When you consider the price of gas, the fact that surveys are showing that people expect only 3% inflation over the next 5 years, that the break-even rate in the bond market is well under 3% now, I just don't understand where the idea that we need to do something like a Volcker in the economy of 22 is coming from.
But what about the idea that so much of this inflation is outside of the Fed's control and so much is due to demand to supply constraints, excuse me. And the Fed, you know, has famously blunt tools. How can the Fed get this under control if they can't drill for oil, if they can't refine oil, and if they can't build houses?
No, what the Fed does is give me the monetary policy to deal with the things I can and to accept the things I can't.
the mantra of Jay Powell,
you
right?
You know, these things will pass. That's the whole point. I mean, the big misjudgment that many of us made was to focus only on these things and think that they were transitory and would pass fairly quickly, but they will pass. And so what the Fed needs to do is to get some kind of underlying inflation rate back to around its 2% range. And then the other stuff will eventually, I mean, gas prices are already coming down. So think about the things that really are the appropriate targets of monetary policy.
On a global perspective, Paul, I mean, you know, a lot of folks have said that the U.S. Federal Reserve is behind the curve, but I look across the pond and I see the Bank of England, okay, 25 basis points. We heard from Christine Lagarde at the ECB that they're thinking about raising interest rates next meeting. How do you think about the European response, and maybe even from the Bank of Japan as well, relative to where the Fed is?
Well, what's the funny thing about monetary policy is it monetary policy starts having an effect before it actually happens, right? So we look at the actual amount by which the Fed has raised rates, and it isn't that much yet. But if you look at the rates that matter for the economy, mortgage rates, corporate bond rates, they're way, way up. So the anticipation of future Fed rate hikes has already done a lot. And the peculiar thing is that although the ECB hasn't raised rates as much as the Fed, those indicators of what people are expecting are every bit as big, if anything, bigger in Europe than they are right now. De facto, the ECB is pursuing a tighter monetary policy than the Fed is, which seems to me to be crazy. I mean, the underlying inflation rate in Europe is probably substantially lower than it is here. They didn't have an American rescue plan. They don't have the rapid wage increases that we've been seeing. So my concern is not that the ECB is behind the curve. My concern is actually that the ECB is way ahead of the curve, and that they're going to do what historically the ECB has tended to do, which is to overcontract.
Interesting. All right. So you mentioned kind of wages, and that's kind of where I wanted to go. The labor market has been just spectacular. We've got, you know, more job openings than we know what to do with here. Are you concerned? Do you think we will, in fact, see meaningful wage inflation? Because the 5%, we see is just not keeping up with that headline number.
Yeah, well, the numbers, I mean, wage rates now are rising. You know, depends on, we're having a lot of problems with adjusting because we have a changing composition. The pandemic and all of that has really screwed up with our ability to interpret the data. But I would have said that we seem to be having wage growth in the 5-ish% range, which, given productivity growth, is underlying inflation in the probably 4 or a bit less range, which is consistent with the other indicators we have. So basically, and wage growth, if anything, seems to be slowing, even though we haven't yet had a significant rise in unemployment. It looks as if the wage numbers are coming down a bit. So wages are not an additional problem. They're basically telling the same story as everything else is.
Well, I have some anecdotal evidence of inflation.
Did you get a raise?
The best hoagies in the world are Hoagie Haven from Princeton, New Jersey. And they actually did raise the prices on the hoagies there. I was down there a couple of weeks ago, and they haven't raised it since 1982.
Wow.
I mean, I don't think so.
So they're making up for some lost time.
So Paul Krugman, down in Princeton, you're seeing some inflation down there.
Oh yeah. I mean, look, lots of things. I mean, it's, I'm surprised actually, given the way that a lot of companies have behaved, they didn't just make the hoagies smaller, which would both be a way to conceal the price increase and probably be good for your health.
Shrinkflation. It's a real thing. I've actually noticed it happening with ice cream.
ice
cream containers I'm buying are smaller. Paul, I'm wondering about the peak federal funds rate. If you would give a prediction as to where you think it'll end up.
Yeah. I mean, this is that's a mystical art. And even the people who do it well do it badly. So, you know, I'd say 300 basis points. Well, what do I know? And the truth is nobody knows. Jay Powell doesn't know. We really are. The Fed is feeling its way forward here, as it should be. I mean, any attempt to lock in a rigid path, given the uncertainties about not just about the effects of policy, but even about where we are. I mean, the U.S. economy is clearly overheated. How much overheated? I don't know. My guess is that the markets are probably overstating how much the Fed is going to raise rates, that it's probably we're probably going to be seeing, just as inflation went up faster than people thought it would, as the economy overheated, inflation will probably come down faster than people thought it would as the economy cools off. Okay. But I can't give you a number on that.
Okay, well, last question, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you. What's the biggest economic risk that lies ahead for the U.S. economy?
Oh, I mean, right now, I mean, there's short term, long term. There's all these horrible things like climate change and war and all that. But short term, it is, I think the biggest risk is that the Fed will overdo it, that it'll slam on the brakes too hard.
All right. There you have it. Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate economist, New York Times columnist. He's distinguished professor of economics at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He's the author or editor of more than two dozen books, joining us via Zoom from Princeton, New Jersey. Paul Krugman, really appreciate your time this afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg Business Week.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Our coverage of the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade continues this afternoon. We're very pleased right now to be joined by Sonia Osorio, the president of the National Organization for Women in New York City. The National Organization for Women is the largest organization of feminist grassroots activists in the United States. Sonia joining us this afternoon from the city. Sonia, good afternoon. I want to just, you know, this. I think this decision for a lot of people was anticipated because of the leak from May. But I'm wondering your reaction as soon as you saw, just after 10 o'clock Wall Street time, the Supreme Court's ruling.
You know, I've been checking my phone over the last days, with each passing day being a little bit more nervous, knowing that the decision was imminent. And I have to say, it still was shocking to see. Mm. And my reaction was certainly one that was shared by many, many people. I mean, my phone has just been blowing up all day with people's just shock and fear and disappointment over the turn of events here in this country for women. You know, a right that we have had for more than 50 years to fundamentally be able to make decisions about our lives, about our bodies. And it's moving forward. It's going to be a very, very difficult situation for a lot of people, particularly imminently as this change goes, starts to take place.
So that's kind of where I wanted to go, Sonia. How do you anticipate this practically unrolling over the upcoming days, weeks, and months? I know you and your organization and others have been, you know, kind of thinking about this and probably planning for it to some degree. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, you know, we have Texas and Oklahoma to look at for what has happened over the last 8 weeks or so there. you know, some of the stories that we are hearing are just devastating. You know, we have the states that remain legal that are in the vicinity of those states where there may have only been one clinic to begin with are up to 5 and 6 weeks with a waiting period. So you can imagine for those women who are pregnant now and are looking for care, it's a panicked scramble to figure out what to do. And, you know, there's one woman's story that resonates so much with me to think about what so many women and families are going through. This was a Texas woman who had to drive to Virginia to get to a clinic because that was the soonest she could get an appointment, which she needed to get one soon. She had to do it. So what this meant for her family was her and her husband packed up their two little kids, drove to Virginia, had the appointment, and they had to get back in the car and drive back because this family, these parents, had to get to their job in the morning. That's the burden that the U.S. government is putting on women and their families in our country now. And when you think about what women have been through over the last 2 years and what they're going through now, from baby formula shortages, child care shortages and outrageous prices for child care, the she session, losing their jobs at really high rates, inflation, gas at more than $5 a gallon. It's really, really a big problem for families.
Sonia, I wonder from a medical perspective what this means for people, for women who are pregnant, but then find themselves with pregnancy challenges. Perhaps their pregnancy was planned, but then they find that it's an ectopic pregnancy, perhaps, or that there's no way that she will be able to carry the baby to term because of genetic mutations within the embryo. What are those women to do?
Well, I really appreciate you bringing that up because it's such a significant point. You know, that's really when things become a very serious healthcare issues. And the talk about morality or ideology and what people think about abortion in general really goes out the window when we're talking about people's health and life. And, you know, this has always been a problem. I mean, this has been a problem for a very long time, particularly for the later term abortions, if they're needed. Very, very few places do them.
So,
and it's a huge burden to women. So it's just going to compound that. It's absolutely going to compound that. And, you know, also, let's keep it into perspective. We've lost Roe v. Wade, but the truth is that it's been death by a thousand cuts for a number of years. Every year at the state level, there are so many restrictions put into place. And there have been women who haven't had access to for any kind of reproductive health care of this sort, that's convenient or within their state.
Sonia, what do you expect to develop here in the city of New York, in the state of New York? How do you think this will play out from in terms of response?
Right. So we are certainly going to be seeing those women who have to get on a plane to come to New York City to have those terminations that are endangering their health. And, you know, one of the things that the National Organization for Women here is launching is an escort service of sorts, a buddy system, so that people who are coming, we can connect people who are coming to the city for services with locals here who will help them navigate the city, help them make appointments, go to the appointment with them if they want, whatever the volunteers are comfortable doing. It may be even offering them a place to stay. We certainly are asking people to donate at this point to the many funds that exist to help cover the cost for people that are going to need to travel. And that's particularly important now because as we've talked about, it's a crunch time now for people who are pregnant with all the changes that have been happening. And there are clinics who have been shutting down their operations over the last couple of weeks because they have businesses that have to be shut down, and they've started that process. So it's a very it's a dangerous time right now. But we are going to be working to making sure that those avenues for people
right.
to be able to get the care that they need, if they have to travel here or to the other, there's only 16
right.
states in the country. So,
Sonia, we unfortunately have to leave it there, but we really appreciate you taking the time. We know you're very busy today. Sonia Osorio is the president of the National Organization for Women in New York City. The National Organization for Women is the largest organization of feminist grassroots activists here in the United States.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Tim, let's stick with the crypto storyline. We were just talking about a story where hackers looted about $100 million from a so-called cryptocurrency bridge, again, exposing key vulnerability in
that's
the
real money, Paul.
Asset. That is real money, but that's the trend. That's clearly the trend. Danielle Dixon, CEO and Executive Director for Stellar Development Foundation, joins us on the phone from San Francisco. And Stellar, you know, it's interesting. It is a nonprofit organization using blockchain technology to unlock the world's economic potential by making money more fluid, markets more open, and people more empowered. Danielle, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. I know you guys recently announced a partnership with MoneyGram. Tell us about that.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's a really awesome. We actually announced the launch of it. So it's really focused on reaching those 1.7 billion folks around the world that don't have access to the formal financial system. And it's really about giving these cash economies an opportunity to be able to get into crypto. Think about it from the standpoint of we've said always all along that blockchain is about those folks out there who don't have access, and yet to be able to get on and to purchase assets, you had to have a bank account or a credit card. Well, you don't need to anymore because you can walk into a MoneyGram location with your cash. You can make sure that you set this up in your digital wallet in advance, and then you can convert that cash into USDC on Stellar, and then hold those assets or do whatever you want with them in your wallet. And you can also do cash out so that you can take the assets that you hold, you can convert them into cash by doing the same thing in reverse and going to MoneyGram and picking up your cash. So it's a really transformational opportunity. And while payments and getting access like this might not be the sexy part of crypto and the stuff that you guys were just talking about before, but this is what brings blockchain and crypto to the masses. So it's just so exciting for us to be able to see this.
Well, it is interesting you say that, Danielle, because I do think a lot about the promise of crypto and the idea of this sort of stateless currency and the idea of cross-border transactions being able to happen seamlessly. I was reminded of trying to, get $80 for a concert years ago from my friend who lives in England, and it was just impossible for him. It was impossible for him to send me the money. And, at one point he was just like, you know what? Next time I'm in the U.S., I'll give you $80. And I'm like, don't even worry about it, Matt, because you're one of my best friends and I don't even care. And it was a great show. But Danielle, it brings me to my point about adoption. And Paul mentioned this most recent bridge attack of $100 million. It comes after we've seen other vulnerabilities with the bridge and other vulnerabilities with crypto. But it also comes at a time when the value of crypto has just fallen so much. And I'm wondering what that does for mass adoption. If people say, you know what, I was into this, but now I'm going to stay away because I don't want to touch this stuff. It's too volatile.
Well, first of all, when it comes to payments and when it comes to being able to move your assets, we really, really believe in stablecoins. And this relationship that we have with MoneyGram, with all these wallet partners out there, can leverage with MoneyGram.
Stablecoin, Danielle, as Katie Greifeld said yesterday, yeah. Stablecoin is almost a dirty word these days in crypto because of what happened with the, algorithmic stablecoins recently.
Well, I think that's an excellent point to bring up because coins that are called stablecoins should live up to their names. They should be stable. When you think about USDC, for example, that's the Circle issued stablecoin, it's backed one-to-one by fiat, and they hold those and they actually keep it so it's transparent for folks to be able to see it. That's crucially important. We support those stablecoins that are issued globally. There are more than 30 issued on Stellar that are backed by their local fiat in much the same way. That's what we think is really important for that. So I want to talk, the recent turmoil in the crypto markets, I just want to emphasize that blockchain technology serves a purpose. It's serving the unbanked, the underbanked populations that are cash-based, and many of them don't have bank accounts. And these 2 billion people depend on cash for their livelihoods. What we're focused on, and what we've always been focused on, is making this real for them. So 60% of the world's adults globally operate in the informal economy in some capacity. And so if you think about giving them the opportunity to be able to hold their value in a way that's secure, that's in their hands, that they control, this is what you can do now when you walk into MoneyGram with your cash and put it into your whatever wallet you choose that's connected to this service. You can do that right now. MoneyGram's offering this for zero fees for the first year to be able to get folks onboarded, to get them used to the service, and to be able to demonstrate the power of it. This is truly transformational and remarkable. And I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in crypto and blockchain, but this is the bread and butter.
So as we get more and more, this becomes more and more of a retail product to the extent that it is adopted, kind of raises the question, regulation. Where do you think we are in the regulatory framework? Where do you think we're going? Is this an SEC type of issue or CFTC? How do you think about it?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. I think domestically in the U.S., we're going to first see regulation around the issue that you just raised on stablecoins. I think we'll see actually some stablecoin legislation. We already see some bills being proposed that's going to give us some clarifying language there that'll make it so that financial institutions that are not banks will be able to issue stablecoins and do it in a way that's valuable to the end consumer. And I think we see a lot of these administrative bodies right now out there really tackling these issues in different ways. And I'll just tell you what I think. I think the most important thing is that governments have always been super successful and really good at regulating money. They've done this from the very beginning, whether it was paper money that we're used to today or gold. So we already have all of these activities set out in all these different regulatory bodies.
Right.
They know how to regulate the activity. Stop focusing on the technology layer and focus on the activity, because the truth of the matter is it's not that different.
Danelle
when
Dixon.
We focus there, we're going to see we don't need that.
Danelle Dixon, CEO and Executive Director of the Stellar Development Foundation, joining us on the phone from San Francisco. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Tim Stenovec and Paul Sweeney live in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, I like nice round numbers as much as the next person. 3,900 for your S&P 500,
wow.
Up 2.8% today, as Charlie Pellett reported. This will be the first up week in about a month, over a month here. So I'm not sure what to make of that, but maybe our next guest who does this for a living, he might know. David Dietz, Managing Principal and Senior Portfolio Strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management, joins us on the phone from the bustling metropolis of Summit, New Jersey. David, what do you make of this week's trading? What do you make of today's trading? A little bit of a dead cat bounce, or do we have the makings of something here?
Well, so that's the $64,000 question. Is this just an oversold bounce, or could it have some legs here? Certainly, there's a lot of positives. We started this year at about 22 times earnings. We came into this week at just 16 times earnings. And of course, you just look at the numbers, we're having one of the worst first halves of the year for stocks since about 1970. And quite frankly, when you look at history, bad first halves are typically followed by good second halves. The other thing I like here is we're detecting some softening in the economic conditions, which could help with the market's worst bugaboo. That would be inflation. So, for example, if you look at real estate, a lot of people are crying in their beer right now as layoffs are starting to mount, as those higher mortgage rates are starting to bite. And, of course, leading indicators like commodities are rolling back. So, for example, look at copper. Entered this week at a 16-month low. Sometimes people call copper Dr. Copper. Dr. Copper, because right. of this uncanny ability to predict economic fortunes ahead. And so that suggests a weakening in the economy and some softening inflation, and then ultimately could help the third bugaboo, which is what the Federal Reserve is going to do. And they're seeming to become increasingly sensitized to possible economic weakness, so perhaps higher interest rates won't continue forever.
Okay, so higher interest rates perhaps won't continue forever. And, you know, I think we had a guest on last week. I forget who it was. I know Ari's going to say the name as soon as I say this, who said that the average amount of time between a tightening and a loosening schedule is only 8 months. So when the Fed stops tightening, on average, we start to see looser monetary policy 8 months. I think it's still too early for us to talk about that. But I do wonder, David, how far you think the Fed will have to go in order to bring inflation under control. And then what will be the consequences of that?
Well, you know, no one knows for sure, but remember, the bond market has done a lot of the work for the Federal Reserve already. We started the year with that 10-year at just 1.5%. It briefly got up to about 3.4%, more than a doubling. It's still well above 3%. And look at what corporations are using and relying on. For example, the most credit-challenged borrowers, the high-yield market, the yields there are now trading between 8% and 9%. And so that's got to slow the economy. We know it's slowing the real estate market. So between the bond market itself and, of course, a lot of jawboning, you know, a lot of sturm und drang by the Federal Reserve, I think we've already started to slow the economy. So it could be a shorter period of time rather than a longer period of time for these rate hikes by the Fed.
So, again, I think a lot of folks, you know, look at this Federal Reserve and say, boy, they got a tough balancing act, you know, trying to rein in inflation while not pushing the economy into a recession, or at least not a deep one. Do you think the Federal Reserve can, in fact, kind of thread that needle, if you will?
Well, you know, they've admitted it's one of the toughest jobs on the planet here is to create that soft landing. And I think the problem is, of course, their key metrics that they're looking at to guide their policy is joblessness and inflation. And those are both lagging indicators, while monetary policy acts with anywhere from a 6 to 24-month lag, right? So they're trying to predict the weather when they land the plane based on the weather when the plane takes off. And so it's not easy. You know, I guess the good news about that, although history doesn't favor them being able to create the soft landing, the good news is they're talking about how difficult it is. And so perhaps they're going to be a little bit more dovish, a little bit more cautious in terms of those rate hikes. And with some softening in the economic metrics that we saw, for example, even today with the Purchasing Managers Index softening a little bit, they may have less rate hikes, and that could help prevent a hard landing anyway.
What's the other data that we need to be looking at, or what are you looking at for indicators that we are starting to see some softening happening? And certainly, you know, the inflation expectations from University of Michigan pulling back slightly from 14-year highs was welcome news to the market. But what else did we need to be looking at?
Well, next week, all eyes are going to be on Thursday's personal consumption expenditures inflation data. You know, that's the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation gauge. And if that shows that inflation is continuing to worsen, I think we're going to see some volatility. If, on the other hand, we just see a little bit less inflation in the latest month versus the prior month, I think markets could cheer that news. And, of course, from a stock investor's point of view, all eyes are going to be on those earnings, those Q2 earnings. We're going to get them in waves starting in mid-July. We're going to see whether stock analysts have been too bullish and how those companies meet those expectations. And, of course, we're going to be listening carefully to the outlook. We know that things did cool off tremendously in Q2. How bad was that, and how is that going to affect what the Fed may do and what investors are going to do?
As a former equity analyst, I'm glad you brought up earnings. They do matter. They do count. And certainly in your initial thoughts on valuation here. One of the challenges, I think, and one of the concerns for analysts is, you know, margins. To what extent are margins under pressure given some of these inflationary trends that we see out there? Is that kind of where you see the risk for earnings here? Not so much the top line, but maybe those profit margins?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you put it in context, which is basically macro analysts see higher earnings in the second half and higher earnings in 2023. And that doesn't square too well with just the overall recessionary concerns. But then you point to where could be the weak link. And that could easily be the margins, as you point out, because with these inflationary pressures pushing up the inputs for production and for services, and of course, we know that wages are starting to go up. And so the question is, if companies are not able to increase prices and pass those along, then you're going to have that shrinking of the margins. We do know that margins are close to all-time highs when you look at history, so it wouldn't be surprising to see those diminishing a little bit. And of course, that's going to weigh heavily on earnings.
David, we only have 30 seconds left here. The S&P 500 having its best day in more than a month since May 4th of 2022. Is the worst behind us?
Yeah. For some sectors, possibly some of the tech names look pretty washed out here, with the Nasdaq down 31%. What we've seen from history is there's not one bottom, but there is a series of bottoms. So some things I would point out is, for example, some of the retailers have really been washed out here. You look at a company like Best Buy, 5% dividend,
right,
but they've increased that dividend 21% per year. Energy, of course, has pulled back dramatically, but they're expected to show some of the highest earnings growth going forward here.
All right, David Dietz, we love it when you join us, Managing Principal and Senior Portfolio Strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management. They've got $10.7 billion in assets under management. Joining us from beautiful Summit, New Jersey. Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.